Welcome to The Exploding Typewriter. This is Pulp Writers on Writing Pulp. I'm your host, Perry Constantine. With Pulp Fiction, they've always had kind of a thorny relationship, let's say, with minority characters. I was in Okinawa this past weekend for the Japan Writers Conference, and I got a question about minority characters in pulp and how those can be explored a little bit. And I decided to bring in to... I was glad that question came up because I actually already booked someone to come on this show. And he is the writer of the famous Dylan series, one of the voted, marked as one of Barry Reese's top new pulp characters recently. And he's a Pulp Arc Award winning author. He also works for Pro Se Productions, writing the Fortune McCall series. And he does a whole lot of other stuff. And that is a very good friend of mine and part of the four-headed, five-headed, whatever it is, monster at Pulp Work Press with me. And that is Derek Ferguson. Derek, how are you doing today?
Fine. I'm doing quite well, in fact. Perry, how are you?
I'm doing great. Great. I'm glad we were able to finally get you on the show.
Yeah. It's been a long time since me, you and I have talked. You know, we've known each other for quite a while. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and congratulations on new podcast, and I know it's going to be a big success.
Oh, well, thank you. As long as I can keep getting people like you on it, I'm sure it will be. Okay, so let's jump right into it, talking a little bit about minority characters in pulp. And you being a black guy growing up in Brooklyn in the 70s, what was your first experience with pulp characters and the minority characters, or the lack of minority characters?
I was first exposed to pulp. Well, I had been a comic book fan, you know, ever since I was knee-high to a knee. So I was familiar with superheroes and stuff like that, you know, Thor being my favorite. And yes, I'm going to go see the movie tomorrow. I already have my ticket. I'm going to be there. First showing.
I'm jealous. We got to wait until February here.
Oh, man. Cruel.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I first, you know, discovered pulp was when I picked up a Doc Savage paperback, as like most people who read pulp, Doc Savage was my gateway drug. That must have been like in the late 70s. There was a big pulp renaissance in the late 1970s where Doc Savage was reissued with those great Bantam paperbacks with James Obama covers, and very quickly the Avenger, the Shadow, G8, Jim Steranko doing the covers of The Shadow and G8. You know, Conan came back in a big way with the Frazetta covers.
Yeah, and also the Marvel Comics series, too.
Right. Tarzan with Neil Adams doing the covers of the paperback. You know, all of this great pulp stuff started being reissued in paperbacks, and I just devoured it like a crazy man. I was like, because, you know, they were pretty cheap back then. You'd get a Doc Savage paperback for like 50 cents.
Right.
75 cents. You know, these things were very cheap. And if you had $5 in your pocket, you'd go home with a shopping bag full of swag, you know, which is what I did. And that's how I got interested in pulp, by reading, you know, all of this great stuff. Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, all of these guys, and Robert E. Howard. That was it. And I was off to the races.
So what'd you feel about, like, you know, pretty much all of them were white guys, though. How'd you feel being a... I'm not sure. How old were you around this time?
Let me see. I graduated high school in 77. I was about like four. I would say like when I read my first Doc Savage, I was like about 15, 16. Okay. Around there, yeah.
Okay, so how'd you feel being, you know, a black teenager and only having, you know, liking this style of fiction but not having any black characters?
You know what? That really didn't sink into me until later on. At the time, I was just reading them just because they were good stories. It was immaterial to me if the hero was white or black, you know. Same way I went to, you know, I watched movies and TV shows. And it never came, you know, the question never occurred to me until I got older and started developing more of a conscience, let me say, about my racial identity and racial identity in the popular fiction that I was devouring, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, I just enjoyed reading a good, exciting story. And that's what the pulps were. Good, exciting stories. The only black characters that I was aware of in Pulp Fiction was the Avenger. He had a married couple, Josh and Roosevelt.
Right.
And they were his aides, and they were college educated. You know, he treated them as equals, and they were equal members of Justice Incorporated. And, you know, they were articulate, intelligent, you know, they were scientists, you know. But most of the time when they were used in the book, they were used where they had to pretend that they were the type of step and fetch it, you know, type of character. Like Josh would go undercover as a janitor, or Roosevelt would go undercover as a maid or some other kind of domestic in order to get information. Right. The way that I came about having to question this material is actually because, and I know people when I tell them this, excuse me, they have a hard time believing it, but it's true. Back then, if you were a black kid in Brooklyn reading this type of stuff, that could actually get you beat up.
Mm-hmm.
There was an incident I'll never forget. I was on the train, and I was coming from school. I went to school in Manhattan, West 50th Street. Back then, it was called New York School of Printing. They changed the name of it now to something fancier. But anyway, I was on the train coming home, and I'm reading a Tarzan book, you know, and I'm reading it, and these three guys, black like me, came and sat down next to me. You know, they were older guys. They were like guys in their 20s, and I'm a kid like about like 15, 16. And they come and they sit down, and they demanded, not asked, mind you, demanded to know why I was reading the white man's racist trash, as they put it. And, you know, I'm looking at them because, you know, because it never occurred to me. You know, it's just a story. I mean, you know, and they proceeded to lecture me on how, you know, oh, you know, this was garbage, and everybody knows that a white man couldn't survive in the jungle like that, and blah, 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 and this and that and the other. And, you know, it was kind of scary. I'm not going to lie. It was kind of scary. But, you know, because to me, you know what? Even at that age, I recognized that this was written in a less enlightened time.
Right.
This is how people saw things back then, for better or for worse. And it does us no good as a society to pretend that this never existed in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, which is a lot of the problems that we have now with racism, because people want to pretend a lot of times this stuff didn't exist, this stuff didn't go on, this stuff didn't happen.
Well, right.
Well, yes, it did. And if no more than as a cultural, we're not even talking about Tarzan and related stuff as entertainment. It's a cultural artifact of how people saw their popular entertainment at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote a whole paper about you know, using Tarzan as an example of like classic Pulp Fiction and comparing it to modern day stuff. I used Charles Saunders' Matimu story as a comparison for it. And yeah, when you look at it, even when you're reading it casually, like you don't always notice it. Like I read Tarzan casually, you know, about a year ago, and I didn't really pick up on a lot of the racist stuff. But then I went back and I reread it for this paper and, you know, doing a much closer reading of it, it jumped out at me, and I was kind of sitting there like, how did I not get this before?
Well, you weren't paying attention to it. Like I said,
right.
You were just reading an exciting story, you know, and that's how I always start with reading something. I read it as a story. I'm not, you know, looking for any deep cultural meaning or anything like that. That comes later on, you know, that, you know, when you're sitting there a couple of days later and you're thinking about, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, that's kind of like, then you go back and you pick up the book and you read, oh, okay, yeah, that is what I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, I was aware that there were a lack of black pulp characters, what I like to call classic pulp characters. When I say classic pulp, I'm talking about, like, from the 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until the pulp renaissance of the 70s, because what happened was that then we started getting the original paperback series, like The Executioner and The Destroyer and The Nemesizer and all these other Izers. You know, these were men paperback adventure series that were in the style of the pulps, but they were original paperback characters. And then we started getting some black characters like the Iceman, who was a guy that had his own army of ninja killer chicks, and he ran a fabulous desert oasis spa where all the rich people came to, and but occasionally he would go out and he would nemesize evil.
I have never heard of this before. I've got to look that up.
Yeah, yeah. It's a series called The Iceman. It was I don't remember how many books there were in the series. I know I owned the first two. I don't know what happened to them. I wish I still had them. I got to go on Amazon or someplace like that, see if I can find them. But yeah, it was a pretty good series. It was pretty good. And he was a black character. So then, you know, once we got those original paperbacks, we did start getting some heroes of color in the mix. But as far as the classics go, I, you know, haven't been able to find any of those. Matt Baker, the closest I could ever come to, and I have to thank Lou Mogan for this. I hope I'm not mangling his name. And if I am, I'm sorry, Lou. who's a comic book writer himself, and he directed me toward a character that was created by Matt Baker, who was an African-American artist. A lot of people don't know about him now, but he's an African-American artist that did a lot of so-called good girl art back then, and he worked on a lot of comic books, and he created a black superhero. He created a black jungle hero, in fact, called Vuda. And he worked on comics like Phantom Lady and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And this guy is like one of the unsung heroes of comic books back in the 40s. And he created Vuda, who was the first black comic book hero. And he was a jungle lord in the vein of Tarzan and Kigor and guys like that. But the interesting thing about Vuda is that after a couple of issues, he was inexplicably and without warning changed to a white guy. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, no explanation at all. You know, one day in first couple of issues, Vuda was, he was most definitely a black guy running around the jungle doing stuff like Tarzan and stuff like that, you know, kicking lions in the ass and whatever. And then, boom, he was just changed to a white guy. So, you know, I've done research on the character. And I'm hoping to, you know, one day maybe do something with him, like update him and, you know, do some stories with him, because I think that he needs to be brought back into the public eye, being as how he's the first black jungle hero.
Yeah. Well, with, you know, Saunders Matimu, and he's coming out with a spinoff for Airship 27 focusing on, I'm totally blanking on the character's name right now, but Lalumba, thank you. Yeah,
Lalumba, yeah,
yeah, yeah. You know, he's doing a spinoff with that character for Airship 27. So yeah, there's definitely a market for that sort of thing now.
Yeah, the last I heard, he was doing a novel with that character.
Yeah, yeah.
He was going to do a novel, and then after the novel comes out, what's going to happen is that myself, Ron Fortier of Airship 27. Mm-hmm. And Milton Davis, who is one of the leading writers in the current steampunk genre of black imaginative literature that's starting up, we're going to be doing stories for the second volume. So that's the current plan with that character.
Yeah, just, not to toot my own horn too much, but that paper I wrote about Matimu, Ron took that and he showed it to Charles and he said, look, see, this shows you that you should write this novel. Because apparently Charles had been going back and forth on it for a while.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was excellent paper. I read it, and I know that Charles must have been delighted to have read something, you know. I mean, because that thing was very well written, very well thought out.
Well, thank you. I was really nervous about that. Then Tommy asked if he could post it. I gave it to Tommy because he gave me a copy of Black Pulp to use for it. And then I sent him a copy of the essay just as a courtesy. And he's like, I'm posting this up if you'll let me. And I was still nervous about the paper. I wasn't sure if it was any good or not, because I'd been out of academics for, you know, like what, like 7 years or so. But yeah, I got an A on it. So,
well, yeah, because you know what? It's obvious. And that's the one thing I've always liked about your writing. I mean, because you're a passionate writer, and it was very obvious, at least to me, when I read it, was that you know, you had a real passion for this subject, and it came through in the writing, and it was well thought out. You know, you presented your argument very well, and yeah, very, very well written.
Yeah, when we're talking about like the black characters in pulp, and beyond just black characters, like, it's always been a problematic relationship between pulp and minority characters. You know, Asian characters probably got the brunt of the poor treatment, being cast as hapless lapdogs, like Charlie Chan type characters, or, you know, there's the sinister Fu Manchu types, the yellow peril, or the Dragon Lady stereotype. And so you had a lot of this stuff going on back then. And yeah, it was also a product of its time. And also a lot of it was because, you know, the pulps were being written, you know, it's not so much the writers, but it was the audience that the pulps were being written for. You know, these were blue collar workers, you know, working class people. And so a lot of those racial stereotypes were very, very much alive back then.
Yeah, well, you know what? Even today, you will have a lot of people that will complain about New Pulp, and they say, well, it's not very well written, it's not very literate, mm-hmm. it's not this, it's not that, it's not that. People are kind of forgetting that Pulp was not written for college professors. It was written for the average working Joe.
Right.
You know, it was written for, you know, people who worked all day long. It was the Depression. There wasn't a lot to be happy about, which is why they called it the Depression. There wasn't
right.
a lot to be happy about. And what these people wanted, they wanted to escape. They didn't have television. They had radio, and they had the pulps. That's what they had. Today, we have 500 movie channels. That's how we get our pulp entertainment. But back then, people, you know, didn't have that. And they just wanted quick, disposable entertainment, something that they could read, take their minds off of, you know, the kids needed braces, the wife is bitching at him that she needs a new refrigerator, you know, his boss won't give him a raise, and a guy just wanted to read a Doc Savage thing and be transported to another world that was a lot better and where the little guy had a chance, and he had somebody like Doc Savage that was looking out for him.
Yeah.
That's what people wanted, you know. So that charge that gets leveled against posts about there being racist and stuff like that. Yes, it is valid, but it was a racist time. It was a racist period. And when people did interact with other races, it was a very limited thing. I mean, you know, people didn't mingle the way they do now.
Right, right.
So people didn't have a lot of knowledge. Most of the time, what they knew about black people or Asian people or any other type of ethnic people that you want to talk about came through what they read, what they heard on the radio, or what they went to the movies to see. And this is what they did. Now, of course, you know, we all mingle and we all, you know, talk and we interact and we're able to get insights into other people's lives and we know what they are. But back in the 1930s, your average middle-class white guy had no idea of what a middle-class black guy talked like, what he ate, what he did for a living. He didn't know anything about him. All he knew was what he read in the pulp magazine.
For the most part, he didn't even know middle-class black guys existed.
Well, there you go. That's another yeah. See, that's a whole other thing we could go into. But for the most part, people didn't know about, you know, other people's, you know, lives or how they lived or whatever. So stereotypes was all they had to go on.
And unfortunately, it still continues to the present day in some form. Just recently, Marvel announced that they're introducing a new Ms. Marvel character who's going to be a Muslim teenager. And my God, some of the comments you'd see on some of the articles about it are enough to make you think that you were back in the 1950s.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I always tell people is that if there is one thing that the Obama administration has done for us, you know, his two terms as president, it kind of pulled the covers off of a lot of the racism in this country, because people want to believe that, you know, when Obama got elected, we were all going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya and, you know, we were going to be this one big happy family and racism would be banished forever. And no, it's not. It came back even worse. And you had a lot of people who were not afraid of expressing their racism, more to the point, you know, whereas before people were saying, you know, they were racist, but they kind of kept it undercover. Not anymore. People felt very, very vocal about expressing their racism.
There's an entire website called Public Shaming that just like reposts racist tweets from people.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, if nothing else, I think that is something that, and actually, and I kind of hate to say this because I'm kind of I try to be an optimistic person, but I honestly despair, and I don't think that racism is something that is ever going to get resolved in this country, at least not in my lifetime. I mean, I'm grateful enough that I've seen a lot of strides that have been made in terms of, you know, injustices against not just blacks, but Asians and all other types of minorities that have been adjusted and corrected and have been modified, but it's still not solved. And I don't know if it's ever going to be solved, but we go on, we live. We can, and we just the way we want to be treated, and maybe that's just a solution as simple as that. I don't know.
Well, so now let's take this back to you and your career. Jumping forward a few years, you know, you're talking about growing up in the 70s and reading pulps in the late 70s and all that. At one point, did you come up with the idea for Dylan?
Okay, Dylan. Dylan was created actually back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had read a lot of these, you know, by now I'd read all of this pulp stuff. I've read thousands of comic books and, you know, I've been writing short stories, you know, about a whole bunch of different characters. And the 1980s was when the various elements that would eventually gel and make up the character of Dylan, I started to pull them together. I sat down, I actually made a list. Because I wanted this character to last for a while. And I sat down and I made a list of things that I saw in classic pulp characters that I felt that, you know, my character needed to have. Like, for instance, I noticed that, like, most well-known pulp heroes and superheroes, like Batman, Superman, Tarzan, mm-hmm. Doc Savage, you know, they were all orphans.
Yeah.
So I said, well, Dylan's got to be orphaned, you know. These guys were orphans, and look how they turned out. You know, they didn't turn out so bad. You know, where was he trained at? Well, I'm going to blow one of my secrets here, is that I hate research. I'm very lazy. I'd rather make up a fact 9 times out of 10 before looking it up. So I didn't want to have to research martial arts. So I made up my own martial art and, you know, say, okay, well, he was trained in that, because then who's going to tell me no?
Yeah, I don't feel so bad about doing the same thing or feeling the same way now.
No. And you know something? You know what? If most writers are honest, they will tell people too. No, they don't do any research. I mean, you know what? Especially when you're writing fiction, you know, because, okay,
yeah,
it's a fictional world. It's my world. So whatever I say happens in this world, you know, it goes. I'm God. I can say, if I want to say that platypuses are blue in my world, they're blue. Who's going to tell me no? You know, and I don't worry about it. You know, yeah, I mean, occasionally I will get an email from people saying, matter of fact, when Dylan and the Pirates of Zanira, you know, was first mm-hmm. published, I got people emailing me saying, well, there's no country of Zanira. And I said, do you realize this is a made up story? It's not real. You know, there's no country of Zanira on Earth. You know, you can't make up a country. Well, yes, I can. It's fiction.
Why not? Yeah.
It's fiction. You know, I mean, damn, you know, loosen up.
It's always amusing where people find that line of suspension of disbelief. You can believe this guy, you know, grew up in this mystical city that, you know, he's trained in this martial arts that nobody else knows about. He has all this technology that, you know, some of it we don't even possess now, but you throw in a fictional country, suddenly that's the line.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, people are really, what was it? There was some woman. Yeah, Dylan and the Legend of the Golden Bell. There's a scene where Dylan is trying to escape from the bad guys, and he's on top of a skyscraper, and the bad guy has built, like, a jungle preserve on top of the skyscraper. Where he hunts animals. So he's hunting Dylan, and Dylan tries to jump over the wall. But, of course, he's on top of a skyscraper, and it's like 100 stories down. And at that moment, a Bengal tiger shows up behind him and jumps him. So Dylan jumps out. He moves out of the way, and the tiger jumps off of the roof and falls to his death. I got an email from a woman, and, I mean, it was a long email going on and on and on and on about, oh, tigers are beautiful animals. and, you know, they should be preserved and, you know, they shouldn't be killed. And they and again, I emailed her back and I said, you do understand this is a fictional tiger. There were no actual tigers harmed in the writing of story. And then wait a minute. She emailed me back and said, well, that's even worse that you would kill a fictional tiger for the sake of a cheap joke. And at that point, I just gave up. I said, okay, well, she just doesn't get it.
Wow.
But going back to what you said, yeah, so the original point of this thing was that, yeah, Dylan started, I created him back in the 1980s. And over the period of like a couple of years, I just refined his character. And it wasn't until, you know, what was it, 10 years ago, you know.
Yeah, 2003.
Yeah, 10 years ago. When I first published, you know, Dylan and the Voice of Odin, that I felt that the character was ready. You know, that's how long I've been, you know, refining the character. Like I said, I wanted to have his whole background firmly in place. I didn't want to, like, write the second or third book in this proposed series and then say, oh, wow, now I got to figure this out. And, you know, I don't have to figure it out because I know the character in this world so well that boom, bing, bang, boom, it just, you know, comes off with no problem.
So what was your mindset when you were creating Dylan? Like, did you set out to say, like, I want to make the black action hero that I never had growing up type of thing? Or was it, or is that just sort of like, that just sort of happened to fall in place? Did you just kind of spring fully formed like that?
No, that was it exactly. That was, you know, okay. I've never made any secret about that because you know what? There's a famous quote, I think it was Maya Angelou who said it. I'm really not sure. I'd have to look it up. But, as a writer, you should write the type of book that you want to read. And that's pretty much what I do in everything I write. Everything I write mm-hmm. is books that I want to read. And nobody else is writing them, so I got to write them.
Yeah, it was either Angelou or Toni Morrison, I think.
Yeah.
It was one of those two.
So pretty much that's what I do. I write the types of books that I want to read. And since nobody else is writing them, I've got to write them. And since there were, you know, I mean, there wasn't any black action heroes around, you know, I said, well, why not write one? So pretty much that's what I did. I just sat down and said, I'm going to write one. I mean, the last popular black action hero that we've had, I honestly think was Shaft.
Probably, yeah. I mean, I was trying to think, too, when you started mentioning that. And I mean, there have been others, but none of them have really achieved the kind of popularity that Shaft did.
Right, yeah, exactly. Not like Shaft. I mean, we have Alex Cross, but, you know, and I guess that you could say he's kind of popular. But really, the ironic thing about this is that both Shaft and Alex Cross are created by white guys.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they weren't created by black. Oh, wait a minute. What am I talking about? What's his name? Walter Mosley. Easy Rawlins.
But yeah, but as far as like mainstream popularity and like even Alex Cross hasn't really been really well known outside of like, you know, outside of the book circles. I mean, they had the two movies with Morgan Freeman, but they didn't really do too well. They didn't really take off, as I recall.
No, because they departed so far from the core character of Alex Cross that you know what, that might as well have been a completely original. They could just call him Joe Neckbone because
right.
It was so far from a lot of people complained about the Tyler Perry movie, but it was 90% faithful to the character that's in the book. And it wasn't that bad a movie. I saw it and, you know, I don't think he nailed it, but he came damn close.
Right.
So, you know, black action heroes are few and far between, which to me is, I mean, if you want to talk about white action heroes, you can just sit down and you can rattle them off all day long. James Bond, John McClane, Indiana Jones, you know, you can just sit and just rattle them off all day long. But when you talk about black action, you actually have to sit down and think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, that's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to write a black action hero that I hoped would connect with, a segment of the population that wanted to read this stuff.
And it came out at the right time too, because I'm not sure when of the new pulp writers, you know, the guys who are actually writing new pulp now, Like, Dylan is probably the first book in that wave that I can really think of off the top of my head.
Yeah.
So you kind of like kickstarted the whole thing and, kickstarted like the modern New Pulp. Because obviously Tommy and I talked before about how it's been kind of staying under the surface the entire time. It's always kind of been there, that style. But as far as like New Pulp itself goes, like the modern day stuff, I mean, you came before the label, but you kind of did kick off like the whole trend more or less.
Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah. Well, as Tommy says, it had always been. Okay. First of all, pulp never really went away. It never did. I mean, right. There were people that were writing stuff in the pulp style. They just weren't calling it that. Clive Cussler, his Dirk Pitt series. And he's mm-hmm. always said this himself. He said Dirk Pitt is his version of Doc Savage. You know, he grew up, same mm-hmm. thing as me. He grew up reading this stuff, and he wanted to write this stuff that nobody else was writing anymore. So, he went out and he did it. And you had a few other writers that were writing pulp stuff. It's just that they weren't calling it pulp,
Yeah.
Until we put a name to it, they were just calling it action adventure, which is pretty much what I say to the layperson. If, a person on this, because my wife loves introducing me as a writer, I tell them I'm a linoleum salesman or something like that. No, seriously, because when you know why? Because when, my husband's a writer. The first thing they want to know is, what do you write? Okay, well.
Yeah.
My phone's ringing. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
First thing they want to know, what do you write? And you can't tell them you write pulp fiction, because if you say pulp fiction, then they say, you had something to do with the movie. So you can't say that. So then if you say, I write new pulp, then they give you that little orphan Annie blunked out look. What are you talking about? So you just fall back on action adventure. Okay. Well, what's the name of some of your books? Oh, Dylan and the Voice of Odin, Dylan and the Legend of Golden Bell, blah, 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 blah. Never heard of them. Well, what are they mm-hmm. about? So you know what? I just fall back on my default answer. It says, do you like James Bond? Yeah. Do you like Indiana Jones? Yeah. Well, it's like that.
Yeah, I do pretty much the same thing, especially being in Japan. If I'm talking with other English speakers, then usually if I got some time, I can explain to them what pulp is a little bit, and sometimes starts an interesting conversation. But doing that conversation in Japanese is a lot more difficult. Right. So usually I just tell them I write action.
Yeah, really, because, if I'm talking to somebody who I know, has read extensively and has even like a passing acquaintance with what pulp was back in the 30s and 40s, then I can go into a little bit more detail and explain. But actually, most people don't really want to know all that. After they want you to explain what it is in 30 seconds or less. And if you can't do that, then they just don't want to hear about it. Yeah, so that's pretty much what I do. I just say, it's like this and it's like that. Because that's what most people ask you. First thing they say, I write this and that. What's it like? Because they want to, mm-hmm. they don't have anything, they don't have mm-hmm. a frame of reference that they can put it in. Well, is it like so-and-so? Yeah, it's like this and it's like that. Oh, okay, cool. Then,
Right. So you started off with Dylan, and then you moved on. You also created Fortune McCall for Pro Se, and then you got invited to do Black Pulp. So why don't you talk a little bit about Black Pulp and what sort of impact you think that's had on New Pulp and sort of like the genre or the medium as a whole as far as minority characters?
Okay, how did I get involved with Black Pulp? I got involved with Black Pulp the same way I get involved with every other crazy scheme Tommy Hancock ropes me into. I'm kind of like his Ethel Mertz to his Lucy Ricardo. he calls me up on the phone and hey, Tommy, how you doing, man? What's going on? Oh, everything's fine. Listen, there's a project I got going on called Black Pulp. You're in. Click. I swear that's exactly how it went down. He said, yeah, and that's what he usually does. He just calls me and says, listen, I got this going on, you're in, click. Oh, okay.
I know exactly what you mean. He started pulling the same thing on me now. He does it on Facebook though. He'll sometimes I'll send him a message every now and then just to shoot the shit a little bit. And I you and I had been talking about, I came up with this idea for doing a Chinese gunslinger, and I asked you if it had ever been done before, and you said, yeah. And you're like, no, I don't think so. And like the next day, I'm listening to an interview that you did with Tommy talking about black pulp, and he mentions that Asian pulp is something they're planning on doing too. So I thought it was kind of a funny coincidence. So I sent him a message. I'm like, hey, this is kind of a funny coincidence. You know, I heard you talking to Derek, and, you know, just before Derek and I were talking about this and about Asian pulp. And he's like, I got one spot open. You're in. It's due like the first weekend of November.
Yeah, boom, that's it. That's it. You know,
it's not even do you want to be involved? No, it's just you're doing it.
Tommy never asks me if I want to be in something. He just calls me and says, listen, this is what I got going on. You're in. Click, and he hangs up before I have a chance to say anything. And then I try to get a hold of him on Facebook. He won't answer me, you know. You know, it's crazy. But you know what? Tommy's a great guy. I mean, I'm so happy for him because I remember years and years ago, we used to be on instant messaging at like at 2 o'clock in the morning, and he was telling me that Prose was just a dream for him back then. And now he's seeing his dream, you know, actually come to life and be a success, and he really deserves it because he's like one of the hardest working men in New Pulp. You know, he's kind of like, you know, and some people are going to be pissed at me about saying this, but when did I ever care about that? He's kind of like our Stan Lee in a way.
I was going to say the same thing. Exactly.
Tommy Hancock is kind of like our Stan Lee in that he's always out there promoting New Pulp, you know, and he's not just promoting Prose, which is one thing I admire about him because you and I know, we have a lot of people in this thing that just look out for themselves. And that's all they want to know is, well, is anybody buying their book? Is anybody reading their book? Is anybody reviewing my book? But no, Tommy looks out for everybody. He wants everybody to do well. And he wants everybody to be noticed. And he wants everybody to be read. And he wants everybody to be a success. And I really admire him for that. And he said, okay, well, this is the project. It's Black Pulp. It's going to feature, you know, Pulp Stories with African-American characters, and I want a Dylan story from you. And I said, oh, okay, cool. I mean, once he told me about the premise, there was no way that I could not want to be a part of it. And, you know, he was telling me about, you know, Walter Mosley was going to write the introduction. Well, at the time he told me about it, Walter Mosley was going to write a story, I believe. He was going back and forth between writing a story and doing the introduction, depending on his schedule. And he ended up doing the introduction. And, so I wrote a Dylan story and sent it in. And it's in there along with a bunch of other absolutely fantastic stories. And it's one of the proudest moments of my career that I can actually look at a book. And Joe R. Lansdale, his name is on it. And Walter Mosley's name is on it. And my name is on it, too. On the cover. If anybody ever told me that I would have my name on the cover of a book along with those two powerhouses, you know, I'd have laughed myself into a hernia. Yeah.
And you actually got you've been an admirer of Mosley's for a while, and you actually got a chance to meet him as a result of this.
Yeah, he had a book signing in Brooklyn, and I went to the book signing at a bookstore called the Powerhouse in Dumbo. Here in Brooklyn, and he came for the book reading, and after the book reading, I walked up there with a copy of Black Pulp, and I introduced myself, and he said, oh, my God. He said, he said, let me see that. He said, I haven't got my copy yet, and he's looking through it, and he's leafing through it, you know, but in the meantime, I still got people behind me that are waiting to have their book signed, so he gives me back the book, and he says, well, just hang out for a little while. He said, let me take care of these people, and then me and you could talk. I said, oh, my God, I got to go to the bathroom first.
Change your pants.
You know, and then I came back after, you know, and he had finished signing all the books. And we hung out for about 10 minutes and we just talked about, you know, Black Pulp. And you know, we talked about the book and, you know, it was just really very cool to hang out with one of my heroes, you know, for 10 minutes. I mean, it was amazing, you know, just talking to him, you know. Just like, and I mean, like, he was just treating me like a, you know, like I was a real writer, you know. He was talking, I mean, wow, it just blew my mind. All fuses blown.
Right. So So did you have any like, I know that there's been some negative reaction to Black Pulp, actually. Did you experience any of that?
Oh, my God. Yeah. You know what? I really hadn't known about it until Tommy, you know, told me about it. You know, him and I were talking on Skype, and he was saying that, yeah, that some people were saying, well, you know, by having a book called Black Pulp, you know, aren't you deliberately segregating yourself? And then why are you complaining that, you know, that pulp isn't recognizing African-American characters or minority characters when you deliberately set yourself on the side? And that, well, you know what? My answer to that is, well, if minority heroes had been integrated into classic pulp back then, there would be no reason for us to do a Black Pulp. You know, there's no reason to do that if we had been integrated into classic pulp characters and had our own classic, Black Pulp heroes. But, I mean, it was a book that, you know, I think that any book or any movie or any type of entertainment comes from a lot of different places. But one of the places it comes from, that somebody sees a need for something and they say, okay, well, I'm going to fill it. And that's what Tommy did with Black Pulp. He said, well, there's a need for this, you know, so I'm going to fill it. And I want Prose to be the one to fill it. And, you know, God bless them. And Airship 27, I don't want to leave them out either, because they published Dambala by Charles Saunders, which features a 1930s, you know, African-American pulp hero, you know, operating back then, which, you know, we didn't have. We didn't have any, you know, Black heroes operating, you know, a la The Shadow and Doc Savage and, you know, these type of guys. And Charles Saunders, he corrected that. So between Dambala and Black Pulp, you know, I think that those two companies are to be commended, because they took that step out there and they said, okay, well, we're really going to shake this genre up and give it something different. We're not going to do the same retread, because you got characters that are floating around that, let's face it, are just very thinly disguised versions of, you know, classic pulp characters, you know. But now, you know, we're getting characters that are more, you know, they're different. I mean, you know, they're not just the same retread of Doc Savage or, you know, the Avenger, or, I mean, you know, The Shadow, whatever. I mean, I made no secret about the fact that Dylan's main influence is Doc Savage, but it's also a lot of other influences that's in there, too. There's a lot of Paladin from Have Gun Will Travel in Dylan as well. There's a lot of Wild Wild West. There's a lot of Our Man Flint. You know, it's a whole lot of different things that are thrown.
Starico's
Nick Fury. That was one of my major influences on it, too. Yeah, I mean, so it's not just solely Doc Savage. It's a lot of different things that's thrown in there. And like I said, those two companies and those two books, Black Pulp and Dambala, they're very significant in that these two companies took that step out there and said, because, yeah, let's face it, they could get by just publishing the same old stuff. But neither one of them do that, neither Airship 27 nor Prose Press. I mean, they've given us female heroes, you know, and like I said, Tommy is going to come out with the Asian pulp. So this is something that's ongoing. You know, it's not just something that was thrown out there just to get attention and create, you know, some kind of buzz, you know, in order to sell other books. This was a profound statement that these two companies were making in terms of new pulp and saying, okay, this is new pulp and this is why it is new pulp.
Going from the criticism, now there's also criticism from another angle, and that's from people saying that, like, this obviously isn't something you'd experience, but something you've no doubt heard about, and that's people criticizing authors who are not of a particular ethnicity or racial background writing a character of that background. You know, so you had, like, you know, Tommy Hancock and Ron Fortier were writing for Black Pulp. You know, I write a female character in the Mythhunter series. I've got, you know, a story in Asian pulp. I've featuring a Chinese character. I've got a story in another prose anthology featuring a Japanese character. So what do you feel about that kind of criticism, saying that, you know, if you're not black, you shouldn't be writing a black character. If you're not Asian, you shouldn't be writing an Asian character, and so on and so forth.
I think that's a lot of horse pucking. To put it mildly, I'm, you know, kind of taking it easy for your listeners. Some of them might have gentle ears. But you know what? You know what always kills me? That if you're a black – okay, like me, I've written white characters. Nobody's ever said anything about, you know – nobody complains when you write about a white character. That's it. But when you're of a certain ethnic background, you write a character of another – you know, then people say, oh, well, you can't do that. I think that it starts with the character first. You got to start with the character. You can't look at, you know, if – let me see how I can put this diplomatically without just sending it into profanity. Both Tommy and Ron are guys, first of all, they're excellent writers. And they have the one thing that is very good for any writer to have, empathy. So they can feel empathy for a character of another race without having to necessarily go live in the heart of darkest Africa, you know. You know, they can write. Right. And you know what? They're not trying to write a black character that encompasses the whole spectrum of the black experience. They're just trying to write a character in a story. Right. And I trust them enough as writers that they know what they're doing, that if they write a character of any, if they write a black character, Asian character, you know, whatever, it's going to be true to whatever that character is. If that makes any sense.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It makes perfect sense. And I agree with you completely. I always think that's kind of an interesting criticism a nonsensical criticism is probably a better way to say it because, you know, no one really complains that Ernest Tidyman wasn't black when he wrote Shaft. Or, you know, in comics, Black Panther is always held up as, you know, a great example of a black character, and he was created by Jewish guys. That kind of thing always it makes me kind of roll my eyes when I hear that. But it's kind of nice to see that kind of perspective from someone.
There's
on the
a great
other side
story
too.
I heard about Ernest Tidyman, and first of all, let me say I have no idea if it's true or not, but I prefer to believe that it's true. He's writing the Shaft novels, and, you know, the Shaft novels are best-selling books and everything like that, and they're great, and the movie is coming out, everything like that. So the NAACP decides to give Ernest Tidyman an award for creating this wonderful black character. So nobody knew he was white. Because, of course, we didn't have the internet back then, so pretty much writers were anonymous. You know, nobody knew.
Yeah, especially... And, like, the cheap paperbacks, they didn't really have,
right,
like, author
photos.
Right, yeah,
exactly. So nobody knew who he was, you know. But everybody just assumed that since it was a black character, the author was black. So they said, you know, Ernest Tidyman, well, we're going to have a banquet. We're going to have a dinner. We're going to give out these awards, and we want you to show up and get your award. So he says, fine. So he shows up there. He goes there. And, you know, of course, he's a white guy, and they stop him at the door. Well, what do you want here? He said, well, I'm here to pick up my award. And they're falling on the floor laughing. What are you talking about? Well, I'm Ernest Tidyman. I write the Shaft. And apparently it took him a little while before he could convince them, yeah, it's me. And this was the first time, you know, I wish I could have been at that dinner. Like I said, I don't know if that story is true or not, but I've heard it like two or three times. But if you want to hear another story about criticism that I've gotten, now this one is really going to flip your wig.
This one, I think I know what you're talking about. And I was actually going to ask you about this story.
You know,
so go right ahead. Yeah.
One of the major criticisms I get.
I do, but for the
it's
listeners,
from black
go
people
ahead.
Who email me and tell me that they don't like Dylan. And, well, why not? Well, because that's not real. Black people don't do stuff like that.
Okay, that's not the criticism I thought you were going to talk about.
What was the one you thought I was going to talk about?
You told me about a story about Dylan and his love interest.
Oh, okay. Well, after this one, I'll tell the folks that.
Yeah,
one.
Yeah, yeah.
But this one, yeah, my major criticism, you know, white people, they email me all the time. They tell, oh, this is a terrific character. He's great. Oh, man, I wish this character had been around before. When are you going to do graphic novels? When is it going to be movies and TV series? But I will get emails from black people saying that, you know, they read the Voice of Voting or they read this and they don't like. Well, why not? Well, you know, man, you know, black guys don't do stuff like that. Oh, okay. Well, okay. Well, I'm sorry you didn't like it. And, you know, I hope I can write something better. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, again, it's fiction. It's not nothing to get bent out of shape about. But some people can't relate to. And I think that's actually kind of sad that they can't visualize a black action adventure hero who does the type of stuff that like a James Bond or Indiana Jones would do. That to them, that's not real. You know, black people don't do that. You know?
When you get emails like that, do they ever offer suggestions on what they think Dylan should
be? They just said that. They just said, well, you know, that's not real. They couldn't relate to that because that's not real. Black people don't do stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
And
I thought it'd be interesting if they gave you some suggestions, like if they said Dylan should be like this or whatever.
Matter of fact, some white people have emailed me and they told me, they said, you know what, I picked it up because other people, you know, recommended it to me, and they said that, well, I had seen it on Facebook or whatever before, but I thought it was just some type of blaxploitation thing or urban type of thing, and that's why I never picked it up. So I don't know. Maybe that's what, you know, these people thought. You know, they thought it was some sort of, you know, urban street lit. And that's why they got it. When opened it up and they, you know, found it was something completely different, maybe that's what it was. I don't know. You know, that's why now the Dylan novels are going to be reissued with new covers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not only just to give them a uniform look, so that people can know that they're all part of a series, because all the covers, the original books as they were printed, were all different covers by different artists. So you really don't know that they're part of a series.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully that these new covers, which are being done by the fantastic Sean E. Ali, hopefully they will emphasize that these are not, you know, street lit, you know, urban novels, so that way people won't be disappointed, you know, thinking they're getting one thing and, you know, they're not getting.
Yeah, and you got a great logo on those books too, designed by, you know, really, really talented designer.
Good looking guy too. I mean, he does work, you know, and he does it. He's quick, he's fast, he's easy to work with, thank God. You know, yeah, but the whole package is just, you know, it looks wonderful. And a lot of people, and, you know, I got to thank you for that logo, because a lot of people have, you know, emailed me and told me, they said, you know, the whole cover front and back just looks fantastic.
Oh, you know, when you told me about that, it was like the first thing that popped in my head. I'm like, I want to see if I can try and do this or, and I wasn't even planning on doing like the final logo. I just thought maybe it'd be, because I knew you were talking to Sean about it. So I just thought, oh, maybe this would be some nice thing that Sean might be able to get some inspiration from or something like that. And then you told me you wanted to actually use the logo. So I was just floored by that.
Yeah. I mean, once I saw it, I said, you know, that's it. That's it. I mean, you know, it's a very dynamic looking logo. It's a very dynamic looking cover, period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just something. Yeah. And Sean, you know, he's like phenomenal. The guy just blew my mind one day. He just put up on Facebook, he did, you know, some Dylan movie style, I mean, you know, posters. And I said, oh, my God. I said, well, what? You know, why? How? He said, man, he said, I just felt like doing it. I said, man, I can't thank you enough. And, so next year we're going to be doing Dylan and the Legend of the Golden Bell. I'm going to, you know, reread that book, and I'm going to, you know, do a little tight. I'm not going to rewrite it. I'm just going to, you know, tighten up, like, the grammar and stuff like that here. And he's going to do a new cover, and you, of course, are going to do a logo. So,
yeah. So now going back to that other story about Dylan's love interest.
Okay. What happens at my darling wife, Patricia, at that time she was working for Verizon, and some of the women on her job, they had a book club, and she talked to them and she said, well, my husband just got a book that came out, and she made a deal with them that if they all bought the book and read the book, she would have me sign it, you know, sign all their books. And a matter of fact, that was one lovely afternoon. We drove out to Long Island, and one of the women, she hosted, she had a whole luncheon for me. She had a whole lunch. And I don't mind telling you that going and having 30 women listen to your every word, it's a wonderful thing. And not say anything, you know. And that's what, there's about 30 of them. And they were asking me questions about Dylan. Oh, are you going to do any more books? Blah, blah, blah. We were discussing the book, and it was just a wonderful afternoon. However, there was one woman, and Patricia said, well, she said she wants to talk to you. She wasn't at the luncheon. So I picked Patricia up from her job, and the woman was with her. And the woman said, oh, she said, yeah. She said, you know what? I read your book, and, you know, I thought it was pretty good, but there's one thing I just can't get behind, and I just wanted to meet you in person and tell you personally and let you know that I want my money back. And I said, well, what was the problem? She said, because there's a part in the book, the heroine of the book, Chris Quinlan, she's a white woman. And there's a part in the book toward the end where I make it pretty clear that, you know, they slept together. You know, I don't make a big deal out of it because I think that when you're on the run from assassins that's trying to kill you, you know, you don't necessarily dwell on, you know, knocking boots, you know, pretty much. But I make it pretty clear what has happened. And she had an issue
right there.
She said that she could not, in all good conscience, support a book where I had a brother sleeping with a white woman. So at this point, because Patricia had no idea what this woman was going to say, and her eyes are just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I know what that means, because Patricia's eyes only get like that when A, she's scared, and B, she's mad. So she's getting ready to say something out of my – and I said, no, no, no. I said, that's right. And I reached in my pocket, and I gave her her money back. And I just thanked her, and I told her, you know, listen, I'm sorry you didn't like it, and I hope what I write in the future – you know, you'll enjoy. And that was it. And, you know, that was it. And, you know, that's why when people, when I read about these people that, you know, do all this bitching and moaning and whining about getting bad reviews on Amazon. Well, you know what? You don't know what it is when somebody's standing right in front of you and they're telling you they want your money back. Now that, you know, that's when you really decide, you know, if you've got what it takes to be in this business or not, because that's not a computer screen.
Right.
That's an actual person right in front of you telling you they didn't like what you write and they want their money back. And you know what? I get and Patricia said, I'm proud of you. She said, because I'd have knocked her out. She said, I'll get ready and knock the heifer out. I said, no. I said, you know what? Whatever you're going to write, it's not going to please everybody. It's not, and that's something that you just got to learn to deal with as a writer. You know, not everybody's going to love what you write.
Yeah. I've never met your wife, never spoken to her, but just hearing that story makes me love her.
Yeah, I mean, she, you know what, and she's a person I cannot stress enough, you know, how much in my corner she is, and it's because of her that I'm able to do what I do, you know. She's behind me 100%. She loves what I do. She went to the first Pulp Arc. She had a great time there. Her and Van Allen Plexico hit it off like, you know, like they were old friends. I said, oh, my, you know.
Yeah.
You know, she just loves the whole, you know, pulp thing. And, you know, I try to get her more involved in it. But, you know, she said, no, no, that's your thing. You know, you know that's yours. You know, you work for this. You enjoy it. You know, so I – and when everybody asks me – you know, well, what's the one thing that a writer should have? I said, an understanding wife. Really, an understanding wife. Because for long periods of time, I have to be down in this basement by myself, you know, writing. And she understands that, and she leaves me alone. You know, and you know, there's some women out there ain't going to like it, but you know who you are. Some women can't do that. So, you're not paying enough attention to me. You know, why are you down there all day long? Why can't you do this? Why can't you do that? You know. But, you know, Patricia very, you know, she does, of course, every once in a while, she says, listen, there's water coming through the ceiling. Could you please do something about, you know, the garbage hasn't been taken out in a week. Yeah. Could you like, you know, but but that's the one thing that a writer, you know, always use, male or female, just an understanding spouse, period, who who understands what you do and why you do it.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I got I've got that with my girlfriend. Like, there'll be times when she's over here, and unfortunately, the way my house is, I don't really have a separate room for writing. So I've got my writing desk in the same room, like basically the living room. So there's the TV and all that kind of stuff in here too. So she'll be sitting here. She'll be, you know, watching YouTube on the Apple TV or using the iPad to like surf Facebook. And I'll be sitting here writing, you know, worried that, you know, I'm neglecting her or something. And she'll be like, no, just do your thing. She's like, I'm on Reddit. I'm on Facebook. I'm fine.
Yeah. And I mean, like, you know, Patricia and I also balance it out, because usually when we're in the house together, usually she's upstairs and I'm downstairs and I'm in the basement and I'm writing. But then so we don't spend a lot of time usually in the house together. Like, she's upstairs doing what she's doing, and I'm in the basement writing. And then in the evening, she'll come downstairs and, like, we'll watch a movie together or something like that. And then on Tuesdays, you know, we take the whole day for ourselves, and we go out and we have lunch and we go to movies, because that's bargain day. You know, it's only $7. So we go to the movie. So, I mean, you know, I balance out the time that I have. Because sometimes I tell her, like, listen, I cannot be disturbed for the next 2 days, because it's something I just got to get done, and I just can't do anything for the next 2. And she says, yeah, okay, fine. She says, I'll go hang out with so-and-so, and I'll leave you alone. And she leaves me alone. And this way I can sit down in the basement. I can be down there for 10 to 12 hours and knock out whatever I have. It is, I mean, you know, to get knocked out. So, an understanding spouse is a blessing. Trust me. And every writer.
Yeah.
If you ain't got one now, get rid of one. You got to get another one.
Exploding Typewriter, breaking up marriages since 2013. Okay. So we're about ready to wrap up here. Do you have any final thoughts on writing minority characters in New Pulp?
Final thoughts. If you want to write a minority character and you are not sure about how you're handling the character, well, it's very simple. If you have a minority friend, just ask them to read the story. It's just that simple. I've had,
okay, great,
you know, writers who have written, you know, black characters in their stories, and they'll send it to me and they say, listen, you know, is this all right? You know, I just want to run this past you and see if it's all right. And I say, okay, yeah, you know, this is cool. Or, you know, well, maybe you could tone down the language here or there, depending on what character that they're writing. Because, of course, if you're writing a story about a pimp from Detroit, he's going to talk differently than from a college professor at Princeton. You know, they're both black characters, but they're going to talk differently, which goes back to what I say. You have to be true to the type of character that you're writing, you know, and there's nothing wrong with writing a street pimp type character, you know, who talks in a certain vernacular, because let's face it, that's how they talk, you know, but you can't have him talking like a Princeton college professor and the Princeton college professor talking like a pimp, unless, of course, you have a reason for that, like, say, like the Princeton College professor is secretly, you know, some type of nighttime Avenger, and his alter ego is a pimp, which actually isn't a bad idea. Now that I think about that,
better write that down.
No, yeah, but you know, that's the best advice that I can give. Because as I tell writers all the time, you know what? You got to listen to your gut, and sometimes. Worst mistake a lot of writers do is that they try to write and edit at the same time, and you can't do that.
It's I do that, but it's a skill I've managed to develop over time from being an editor as well.
Right. And you have to listen to your gut. You can't overthink everything. You know, it all can't come from your head. Some of it has just got to come from your gut. You got to feel your way. And if it feels right, then go ahead and do it. I mean, because after all, again, this is fiction. This is fiction. This is supposed to be fun. You know, you're not supposed to open up a vein and, you know, bleed all over the thing and, you know, agonize. And, you know, I know some people feel that that's what writing is all about, that you have to angst and agonize and everything like that, you know, but I don't have any illusions about what I do. I'm not James Joyce. I'm not even Ellen Joyce. You know, I mean, really, I mean, I'm not, you know, one of those literary writers. You know, I'm not trying to write, you know, from here to eternity or War and Peace, you know, and honestly, that's what most of us in New Pulp, you know, are just trying to do. We're just trying to entertain. And in order to do that, the first person you have to entertain is yourself.
Even with those literary writers, I think, you know, the ones who other, I think there's, they definitely enjoy what they do, and otherwise they wouldn't keep on producing so much work.
Oh yeah.
So I think that's a big thing with it. Yeah, but like you hear these, you know, aspiring writers who hate writing.
Yeah.
And so basically there are times when it's stressful and times when, you know, the muse isn't speaking to you and when it doesn't work, but if that's how it is all the time, you should really be finding something else to do.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's never going to flow the way you want it to all the time, you know, and we all have bad days. We have days when, you know, we don't even want to look at the damn computer and everything. And, you know, it's like that line from that Bruce Springsteen song. I'm sick of sitting here trying to write this book, you know. Serious. You know what I'm talking about. You get to that point every once in a while. You know, I don't want to even look at this anymore. I remember one time, and I know you want to wrap this up, so I'm not going
to. That's okay. I actually just remembered something else I wanted to bring up, too, so go ahead.
Okay. I was talking on Skype one time. It was a guy that had read Dylan and the Voice of Old, and he wanted to talk about it, and he sent me an email, and he said, well, can I talk about it on Skype? I said, yeah, okay. So I get on Skype. So he's asking me about a scene in the book, and I say, hold on a minute. And I go to the bookcase, and I get my copy of Dylan the Voice of Odin, and I open up to the page of the scene. And, and I'm saying, okay. And there's a long pause. I notice the guys are talking. I said, well, what's the problem? He said, you had to go get the book to look? I said, yeah. He said, but didn't you write it? I said, yeah. He said, but you don't remember what you wrote? I said, hell no. I said, I had to read this fucking thing 50, 60 times while I was writing it. I don't want to read it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that really, you know, he said, man, if I could write like you, I'd be reading my own stuff every day. I said, no, you wouldn't.
No, you wouldn't be.
No, you wouldn't be. Because you'd get sick of it after a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, after a while, I just don't want to read it anymore.
Well, also, you just can't, being the writer, you can't help but look at it more critical than anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, nobody's harder on you than you are.
Oh, I mean, when I had to re-edit the book for the 10th anniversary edition, I was getting ready to drink Drano. I said, oh, my God, how could this guy? I mean, the grammar was, oh, my God, the clunkily written sentences. But you know what? That was good because obviously since I caught that, that means I must be developing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have caught it. But, yeah, I looked at it, and I saw all of these holes in there. Matter of fact, I even saw one big plot hole that nobody caught, and I plugged it.
Really?
I did. I wrote about 1,000 words. I said, damn, I can't believe nobody saw this. And I wrote 1,000 words real quick, and I plucked it up. Oh, man.
You don't really notice the changes you made. Like, I mean, I read the book years ago, but then I reread it when I was doing the ebook for you. And, you know, other than the opening chapter, which you added to it, I didn't really notice any huge changes.
No. I mean, I really made a promise to myself, and I even wrote it, and I put it up on the board above my desk, do not rewrite.
Yeah.
Because the temptation was there to extensively rewrite the book. And I didn't want, like you said, the only major change I made to it was that the short story, Dylan and the Escape from Toseggio, I made that the first chapter, which it really should have been all along.
Right.
It should have been the first chapter. That's really the only major change that I did to the book. Everything else is purely cosmetic. It's just a facelift. You know, sentences, I tightened up, you know, there was that little 1,000-word thing I did to plug in a plot hole. But other than that, I didn't change anything. I just tightened up the grammar, cleaned up a few clunky sentences here and there, and that was it. Essentially, except for that first chapter, essentially that's the same book that was published 10 years ago.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, I've written different minority characters before. I've written black characters, Asian characters, you know, Hispanic characters, women characters, gay characters, all of them. But the one thing that always trips me up when I'm writing is if the story ever calls for the use of a racial slur or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel when you see a white writer do something like that? Is that something that strikes you, or is that something that, you know, you just figure it's part of the story?
It's part of the story. I mean, because let's be honest, that word does get used. People like to, that's a horrible word. Well, yes, it is a horrible word, but unfortunately, it is a word that gets used. And I've used it myself. in a couple of stories. I mean, I used it in Brooklyn Beatdown, which is my fight card novel that is set in 1950s Brooklyn. And as a matter of fact, I didn't use it as much as it should have been used, because growing up in the 70s, like I did, that was a word I heard constantly.
Right.
And it was used by black people, you know, and it was thrown around constantly. And, you know, it was. And when I wrote that book, I said, well, because I knew that Paul Bishop, there were certain things that he wanted, and the language and the violence should have been about, like, say, PG-13 language and violence. So I kind of agonized about that, because I said, well, you know something? I can't be true to the time period and where it's set, because it's set in 1950s Brooklyn. And that word was used. I said, I can't go through the whole book without it being used. But yet I knew Paul didn't want me to go overboard with it. So what I just did was that I just told him, listen, wherever you feel that it's not needed, you go ahead and you cut it right out, which is what he did. So I think he left in like two or three, which is okay.
Right.
I mean, it's okay. But it's used during moments of dramatic tension to heighten the dramatic tension. Mm-hmm. Whereas in my version, I just had it being thrown out during, you know, common dialogue.
Right, right.
So, but when other writers use it, and I believe in putting things in context, I put it in context of the story I'm reading. Okay, I'm reading this story. Where is the story set? Who is the character saying it? And why is he saying it? And if it feels right to me, then I don't worry about it. If I feel like he just threw it in there just because he figures he can get away with saying it in a story that he couldn't, then I have exception to it. But that really doesn't, nah, it really doesn't bother me. It really doesn't.
Yeah.
It really doesn't. Because unfortunately, like I said, if we're writing stories about characters, and if we got to be true to these characters, then we have to be true to how they talk and how they think and how they act. And if you do that, then you can't go wrong with me, at least not with me.
Yeah, that's the one thing that's probably the most difficult thing if you're a white writer writing for minority characters, is how do you deal with that? I mean, that's the one thing I agonize over, because you see, you get these stories about, you know, Spike Lee bashing Quentin Tarantino for using the N-word in Django Unchained and stuff like that. So yeah, it's good to hear that that's not necessarily like the prevailing opinion.
But see, here's the thing about that whole thing. And you know, people were asking me about that too. I said, well, first of all, he has Samuel L. Jackson that was in the movie. And Samuel Jackson, as we know, don't bite his tongue. And if Samuel Jackson had a problem with that word being used in the movie, I'm damn sure he would have told Quentin Tarantino. But he didn't have a problem with it. Second of all, I know where Quentin Tarantino was coming from as a filmmaker. Quentin Tarantino grew up primarily, and he said this himself, primarily in a black neighborhood. This was the period when his mother had a black boyfriend, and the boyfriend would take him to the movies. And he would go see all these blaxploitation movies where that word was used quite frequently. Yeah. So, you know, his movies and all of Quentin Tarantino's movies are basically throwbacks to 70s exploitation movies when racial slurs were used a lot. I think what happens is that people have kind of, again, I go back to what I was saying before, people would like to believe that, you know, these words don't exist and people didn't say them. But unfortunately, yeah, they did. You know, they said them and they do exist, you know. So if you're going to do a movie about slavery, and it's impossible to do a movie about slavery, even if it's a pulp action adventure, like which is what Django was. You know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It's not like 12 Years a Slave, which is like, oh, my God. You know, oh, man. And if you go see that, I advise you go see it early in the day. Don't see it late. You know, don't make that the last thing. Don't make it the last thing you see before you go to bed. But it's impossible to do any movie about slavery without using that word. It just ain't it just ain't going to happen. I'm sorry. And as I tell people, I say, you know what? They used to make movies with that. The Legend of Nigga Charlie with Fred Williamson. I said, and people look at me like I'm crazy. I said, yeah, that was a movie. Then, no, man.
Yeah.
Lying. Yes, it was. Look it up. It was. That was right there on the marquee. You have to make up your mind, you know, as a writer. OK, is this something I'm willing to deal with and I'm going to work with and I'm going to work through my own little peccadilloes to get to the truth of this character in this story, or am I just not going to write the story at all? Because as a writer, you do have that option. If it makes you uncomfortable as a human being, well, then don't write it. It's just that simple. But then people, oh, well, that's censorship. No, it's not censorship. If you just don't.
Yeah.
You know what? I would rather a writer not write anything at all if they're uncomfortable with dealing with that than do it half-assed.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great advice to end the show on, actually. So right before we send you on your way, this episode will probably be dropping, you know, sometime late November, early December, probably.
Okay.
So if you want to go ahead and promote anything that you got coming on the line or anything that's out already, feel free.
Let me see. I don't have anything coming out yet. I'm working on a couple of things right now. I'm working on, by the time this comes out, something that you are acquainted with, Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell, which is a story I've worked on for 10 years. And I finally decided to finish it because people have been asking me about it for 10 years. And it's going to be a, at the time that you hear it, hopefully it'll be out. It'll be a free ebook. What I'm probably going to do is I'm probably going to put it up for about like a week or something like that. And then I'm going to take it down and then reissue it next October. You know, kind of like a seasonal thing.
Right.
You know, for Halloween. It's actually based on a Hammer horror, based on one of the Hammer horror movies. There was a whole series of movies they did. They did four movies with Peter Cushing playing Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And this one is based on that movie, but it's on my own unique spin on it. I am also working on another project, which you know about. It's a Dylan story. I have not told anybody about it except for you and two other people. But it is a Dylan story that truly sees Dylan in a way that nobody has ever seen him before. So if you're a Dylan fan, you are definitely going to want to read this one. Because
I managed to get a sneak peek at that. Not sure how I managed to trick him into doing that. But when it comes out, you'll know about it, and it's good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Matter of fact, I've written a lot more of it. I got to let you look at it, get your opinion.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. But I'm almost finished with it because I cracked 16,000 words, and it's only going to be about 30,000 words long. This is a whole new Dylan. Nobody, I guarantee you, folks, you've never seen him like this before.
Where can people find you?
Oh, they can find me all over. I'm not hard to find. I'm on Facebook, of course. I'm on Twitter, even though I don't tweet all that much. But if if you want to keep up with me, there's my Facebook page. If you would like to read any of my thoughts and keep updated on what I'm doing, there is my Blooded Ink blog, where I do book reviews occasionally. I do interviews with other writers and other creative folks. That's my Kicking the Willy Bobo series of interviews. And I keep people updated as to what's going on. There is my Dylan blog, which is solely devoted to Dylan. There's articles up there that other people have written about him. There's chronology that gives you the order in which you should read the stories, background about the character, his supporting cast. There's a casting call that I do up there. I occasionally update it where there was a Dylan movie. These are the actors I like to see play the role. And then there is the Ferguson Theater, which is my movie review site. As most of you may or may not know, Perry, you know this, I'm a fanatical movie fan. Mm-hmm. And, I just started writing movie reviews on LiveJournal. And that was years ago. And then after LiveJournal kind of folded, because nobody really uses that anymore. People were telling me, oh, well, you ought to put them on, your own blog. So that's what I did. And they're up there, something like 400 and something reviews now. So if you like movies, go over there and read one of my reviews and then email me and tell me what you think.
Yeah, it's a wonderful site. I've gotten so many there's so many great movies that I never would have seen if I hadn't read one of your reviews about them first.
Yeah. I mean, and I should mention Better in the Dark as well, the podcast that I co-host with Thomas DJ, who is a fabulous writer in his own right. And it's a podcast where we talk about movies. We talk, argue, compare, fuss back and forth. And one of the pleasures that I really get is when people read one of my reviews and then they email me and say, hey, man, listen, thank you for turning me on to this movie. I had never even heard about this movie before. And, you know, I'm glad you told me about it. And I feel really good because there's a whole universe out there of movies that people just don't know about. You know, there's more than just the latest blockbuster of the week out there. You know, there's so many terrific movies out there. And I'm just glad that, you know, I'm able to expose people to them and, you know, they get a chance to see them.
And now with Netflix, it's so much easier to watch them.
And you know what? That kills me when people talk about, oh, there's nothing to watch on Netflix. Well, what do you mean there's no? Well, they got a bunch of old stuff on there. Well, have you seen it before? No. Well, then it's new to you, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, my queue is like up to like 300 or something. I'm never going to be able to get through all of it.
Man, you know what? I could sit and watch Netflix for a week. Matter of fact, one time I think I did. I just said, I mean, you know, when I first got, because you know what? It was all these old movies that I hadn't seen in like 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And they had it, which is the one thing that I really love about Netflix. They got all these old movies that I said, oh, man, I haven't seen that since it was on 42nd Street back in 1986. And I'm sitting there and I'm watching it, you know. So, it's a terrific resource to find movies that you may have heard of, but you've never seen before. And they've got them on there. Netflix is, man, what are you talking about? Siri, don't take my Netflix away. Between Netflix and Turner Classic Movies, that's it. I could live. You could take everything else I got.
I've got Netflix and Hulu Plus, and that's basically all I need. I've got everything I need right there, and it's, you know, like what, like $14 a month for both of them combined. So I pay far less than I would for cable out here. Cable out here is ridiculous, and there's nothing on it anyway.
Oh, I can imagine. Well, we've got DirecTV, and actually, if I had my way, that's probably what I would do. I would just disconnect everything, and I would just keep Netflix and go Hulu Plus and stuff. But there's a whole other stuff that my wife likes to watch. Like she's hooked on Home Garden TV and, you know, the shopping, you know, QVC, of course, and other things. So, well.
What can you do?
Listen, it keeps her out of my hair, so. doesn't do much for my bank account, though. But.
All right. Well, Derek, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, and we'll have to have you on again sometime, talk about another topic.
Oh, absolutely. Well, listen, you know how to find me. I'm not hard to find. Anytime you want me to come back on, just send up a smoke signal.
Okay, great. And as always, check out the website for show notes, and you can find links to Derek's numerous sites and some of the books we talked about on here. And this has been The Exploding Typewriter. I'm Perry Constantine. Have a good one.
This has been an episode of Exploding Typewriter, Pulp Writers on Writing Pulp. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be sent to typewriter@percivalconstantine.com. Join the conversation on Twitter @explodingtype or use the hashtag #newpulp. Visit typewriter.percivalconstantine.com for show notes and links where you can find more information about this episode's guest. The theme song for this show, Faster Does It, was created by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com and is used under a Creative Commons license. If you enjoy the show, please support it by posting a review on iTunes and tell your friends.